Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And SouthsideBroadcasting.podbean.com.
Epic. That's all you can say about that, to introduce the second part of Sound and Graham's Vision, Sound and Director's Vision with Graham Harper. Epic in every sense of the word, of course, of the David Lean movie Lawrence of Arabia. Graham, welcome back to your show.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much all. the reason really for my wanting to talk about music is I've had such a diverse interest in music throughout my life. Really from the age of 10, I can remember. That's where music really affected me, by listening to jazz, which I said before, on Forces Network Radio from Germany when I was a kid, you know, under the bedclothes late at night when I should have been fast asleep, blah, blah, blah. But all this music gradually throughout my life brought me lovely memories and classical uses to describe the kind of music I would like to use to back up scenes in different productions I've done. And I never realised how important music was going to be to me, because I never imagined I'd really ever get to be a director. That really was wonderful when it happened. And then I had the opportunity to use music. So I had a lovely library in my brain of music that I could refer to. I'd like something in the style of, etc., etc. So by the time I went to see Lawrence of Arabia, which absolutely spellbound me because of its beauty, because of the shooting of it, and the music was stunning. Now, of course, as a young guy going to the cinema, I wasn't thinking about how much music was going to be important to me for filming, but I was very aware of how great the use of the music was in David Lean's film. He is a master. I never really recognized how good he was, but as I grew older and got to see more and more movies and worked on television productions, I realized this guy is a genius, both in his visualization of his movies, his use of the actors he used, and the music that he also had composed for him. That must have been a lovely discussion that he had with the composer to create that music, because it was beautiful, evocative of the desert, and Lawrence's first arrival in the desert, the way he walked. I think there's a lovely shot where he is going through a sort of ravine with the desert kind of stretching out beyond him. Oh, the lighting and it was stunning. And that music, every time I hear it, I remember that shot, that visualization. Isn't that wonderful that a director could have that as his kind of signature? It's brilliant.
Jeffrey Unsworth, I believe, was the cinematographer. I think he was involved with it, and obviously he had a very long and distinguished career. And of course, the movie itself still winning awards. I mean, 2013, it actually won the Saturn Award for Best 50th Anniversary Collector's Edition re-release from the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy and Horror Films in the United States. From the point of view of casting, let's talk about that initially. The rumours were that Peter O'Toole wasn't really in the running at the start, and originally David Lean was looking for Marlon Brando in the role.
Could you imagine? Oh, extraordinary.
But it brought me around to that notion of, where in television, have you ever had any say in the casting as yet? Or has that been a case of, well, you just sort of wait and see, or do you have sort of certain roles in mind for individuals?
I think most of my career, my experience has been collaborative with the producer. That may have changed slightly now, because you have showrunners, executive producers and producers, and I'm not sure until you get onto each production, I'm never sure who is the real boss that you're going to be discussing all the detail of the casting with. But it's usually the producer. If you work with Russell T. Davies, he's the showrunner, for example, on Doctor Who and all his projects. He has a very strong say in the selection of artists, but it is collaborative. You will put up several people that you think would be wonderful for certain parts, and he would definitely have a say of, oh, no, I'm not sure about that person, but yes, I love those two ideas. And then you're left with a variety of options that he would be happy with any way the majority would feel we should go. So it's a collaborative thing. It's not you, it's dictated to. Now, in big feature films, often I think to get the money, the producers, before they even get the director, probably have somebody in mind that will financially, who's bankable, will actually, you know, help to raise the money from investors who would be excited by that big star name being involved with the project. And I suspect directors sometimes, not always, but sometimes a director might be employed to come on board with that as a fait accompli. That's the artist he's going to have to work with as the lead. But the rest of the casting, or maybe the one or two of the main characters will be presented like that. But the rest of the casting is very collaborative again.
Well, David Lean, of course, also had Albert Finney in mind, who I can understand Albert Finney more so than Marlon Brando. But again, it's an interesting sort of choice in terms of where obviously Peter O'Toole clearly nailed it. Do you think the movie still stands up today? I mean, I know we're not focusing hugely on Lawrence of Arabia, but I mean, looking at it, it's 3 hours and 36 minutes long. It has no women in speaking roles, so it basically puts a nod in the direction of the diversity movement. And it's reportedly the longest movie not to have any dialogue spoken by a woman. I don't think you get that past any of the sort of screen groups today, basically, but maybe that's a good thing.
Yes, probably not. Yes, I do think it stands up. I think it's he's a classic director. He is one of the great directors that will always be remembered and will be up there with the gods. And for very good reason, because he was a very, very organised, well-sorted director. From what I understand, I never met him, but from what I've read about him, he was pedantic. You know, he was absolutely on the money with his preparation. He knew exactly what he was going to achieve. And I'm absolutely certain he would have collaborated with the people who he surrounded himself with to make his projects so that he would have, Jeffrey Unswood, your DOP and operator and operators are very, very, and sound supervisors, sound directors are very, very important to you in terms of sound and technique, you know, and visuals, how it's going to look. Everybody is important on a shoot, and he would recognise that and would recognise great achievement from very lowly people. I'm absolutely certain. I think that's what makes a great director or helps to make a great director, that he recognises the talents he surrounds himself with.
He also had a screenwriter, Robert Bolt, who, interestingly enough, had actually been jailed for participating in the nuclear disarmament demonstration and was only released after producer Stan Spiegel actually persuaded Robert Bolt to actually sign an agreement of good behaviour. Never really thought of Robert Bolt as...
I didn't know that.
How he just sort of Yeah, it's very, very, very strange. And actually, David Lean also, in something which I think, again, these days we regard as fairly unusual, never actually saw any dailies whilst production was taking place. So he never looked at any dailies whatsoever until he came to the editing, only missed one day of work, although the production itself endured many illnesses.
Now, that's extraordinary. That tells you two things. One, it tells you how confident and certain he was of his ability, and also how confident he was in the ability of all the people who surrounded him. Because often, I don't mean every day, but often in production, something will go wrong. So presumably there was a producer keeping an eye on all the dailies and telling him, you'll have to reshoot that, or the big wide angle you had has got a big smear across it. I mean, surely he was
told... The match hasn't worked. When you've tried to light the match, it hasn't gone.
I've got a feeling he would have seen that, but that's very brave of him. I always watch, look at rushes, always, if they're available to me. It depends where you are on location and whether it can get, because the stuff could be got to you in time for you to be able to pick up anything you felt was not as good as you hoped it was. So he's very brave. That shows his surety of his ability.
I mean, we talked in the first show, of course, about his Bridge on the River Kwai. So clearly having that under his belt, and obviously Brief Encounter, kind of like the two extremes of kind of very tight storytelling and sort of emotional storytelling to the epic Bridge on the River Kwai. Do you think he kind of got to the stage of he was confident but not overconfident? And as you said, he surrounded himself with the people he knew could do the business.
Yes, all of that. I think I don't know if he was overconfident. I just think he was so experienced and he knew his stuff. I don't think anybody, I'm sure of, you know, beneath him, I don't think anybody would have argued much with him, but I'm sure he was collaborative. I'm sure people were able to offer him ideas that he would be able to say yes, no, whatever. Again, that depends on the pressure he's under to get stuff shot. If he's nearing the end of the day and he hasn't quite, you know, completed all the slates he wants, he's not going to be pleased to listen to other people's suggestions. He wants to get on. And the best thing then is to do what you've got planned, because you're not going to waste time discussing it. But I'm sure at the beginning of the day, and for most of the day, I'm sure he was collaborative, that he would listen and hear wonderful ideas. And obviously, he'd need to be open to see. There's a wonderful shot, and I can't remember the detail of it to tell you, but there's a fabulous shot in that film, Lawrence of Arabia, of the sun, a big sun sparkle comes across the lens, and it's almost like a crucifix. It's an extraordinary visual that you don't plan for necessarily. I mean, a DOP can give you that. When I say DOP, I mean a director of photography. He will be able to create an effect. But I think this one was by luck. It had to happen. And I think the operator said, oh, sorry, Gov, that may not be any good to you because of a huge sunburst right across the lens. And he went, no, I love it. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic. We'll keep it, move on. Because it's in the film and it is a magical moment. And you wonder, was that planned or did he happen to just grab that? And if you're open enough to be flexible enough to be able to say, no, I love that, confident enough, I'm going to move on. I think it's brilliant. I'm sure it'll be wonderful.
He obviously was very fond of Marlon Brando because he tried to cast Brando in two of his later films, both Dr. Zhivago and Ryan's Daughter. And Mr. Brando didn't even reply to his requests, apparently.
Oh, so. I find that extraordinary. I'm laughing because... Not because Marlon Brando would have been completely wrong for any of those films. They would have been magnificently different, but he would definitely have been watchable. I can imagine him in Lawrence of Arabia, but I'm not, and he's also got a very good English accent, so I suspect he, from that point of view, he would have been very passable. And he's exciting. He was an exciting actor, really wonderful to watch. I'm glad he didn't want to do any of them. I think Peter O'Toole was just fabulous in Lawrence.
Interesting, again, in terms of Brando, of course, and he had his own epic challenges with Mutiny on the Bounty, which was filmed, I think, sort of around about the same time or slightly later in terms of his own side of things. We'd have to ask our film critic colleague, Richard Fitzwilliams, to actually clarify details on that.
Oh, it'd be exciting to hear what he's got to say.
Indeed. Going back to the music, it's interesting that the movie does credit Sir Adrian Bolt as the conductor, although apparently the official line is that Maurice Jarre conducted every note of the recording, because in the text Beyond the Epic, The Life and Films of David Lean, a book by Gene Phillips, Bolt found conducting a movie score so overwhelming that he actually handed the job over to Maurice Jarre. And the only reason that Adrian Bolt's name is still listed is for contractual reasons.
Ah, I'm afraid I don't know that. That's all news to me and very interesting. I'm not sure. Does it matter?
Well, that was my question, actually. Does it matter insofar as he's up there? And yet it's Maurice Jarre who's basically directing all of the music, and it's his score, of course.
Yes. Oh, it's magnificent. I won't pick out any one particular one apart from the main theme, which opens the film and then is used periodically through the film. It's so beautiful. It's one of those great... It's like From Russia With Love name's gone right out of my brain, having said that.
But John Barry.
Not John Barry. Matt Monro.
Oh, it's obvious.
And again... Just digressing, Matt Monro sang that song. It actually, the tune itself was used as the opening title. It was never used as a song until the end. And I think you hear it on a radio somewhere in the early part of the film, which is interesting because it's so memorable and very vivid of that film, just like Lawrence of Arabia, the theme tune. It takes you right back to that film and the images.
And certainly Michelle Monroe, Matt's daughter, will be pleased that you acknowledged and remembered that particular story, because it was absolutely true that I think the Monroe family had actually gone to the screening and wondered what had happened to Matt's signature theme tune, which didn't turn up, as you say, until right at the very end. You've mentioned, of course, Peter O'Toole's performance. It's basically ranked as the number one performance of all time in Premier Magazine's 100 Greatest Performances of All Time. Does it merit that accolade, the greatest performance of all time?
Oh, I'm sorry, Sir Peter. I don't agree with that, but I know what she means. I think it is such a fabulous performance from a newcomer, really. I mean, I'm sure he was known, but he wasn't known as a film star then. You think of him when you think of Lawrence of Arabia, you know, and that movie. There are some fantastically huge performances alongside his, so he would share it, I think, but he's not the only, he doesn't own it, that right, I'm sure.
Perhaps the words of Noel Coward should be used here. He's rumoured to have actually said, when he saw the premiere of Lawrence of Arabia, and this is about Peter O'Toole, if he'd been any prettier, they'd have had to call it Florence of Arabia.
Yes, that would be right coming from him.
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, he went on to do the Italian Job and other sort of fine things as well from that point of view. Of course, there was that sort of similarity because Jack Hawkins appeared in Bridge of the River Kwai and, of course, makes an appearance in this movie as well as some of the other greats like Anthony Quayle and the wonderful world of Invisible Man, who's Claude Rains, who's also there. Some traditional good quality English acting talent there, I think, that was made use of, which is again another reason why I was bemused by why Brando was actually up for the role, really. Just curious.
I can't imagine the arguments that would happen. It would have been volatile, the whole thing. It's really interesting because going back to something you were discussing earlier about the sort of quality of acting and the techniques and styles of acting throughout the Annals of Time. We're still, even with Lawrence of Arabia, which was a good 10 years after, if not longer, after the Dam Busters and the Bridge on the River Kwai, where we talk about that kind of slightly heightened, terribly British way of playing. It's kind of the same here. It's brilliant. It's evocative of a period, of a time. And I think people did speak the way they did. I mean, Lawrence of Arabia isn't over the top and odd and peculiar. It's not dated. I think that's the point. It's not dated.
If you can cast your mind back to the young Graham Harper there, who is literally was sort of 1961, 1962, of course, Lawrence of Arabia is actually released from that point of view. You're gradually sort of moving on in life, Conti and various other bits and pieces. when you saw Lawrence of Arabia, was it everything you expected? Was it something which you kind of looked upon at the time as being wow, a definitive wow movement? Or was it something which was, well, it's another movie, let's go and see it?
It was very well advertised that we were going to see a big epic. It was David Lean. I, again, as I said to you before,
could have been
man,
another Cleopatra, of course. Could have been another Cleopatra.
Well, you see, I like Cleopatra. I know it was a huge, lengthy, not flop, but it was not the great movie I think everybody was expecting. It was far too long or whatever. I thought it was wonderful, and I'm sure I'm joined by many people who feel the same. I went to see it knowing I was going to watch a great war movie of some sort, and I didn't know too much about Lawrence of Arabia, although I did know some because my grandfather and grandmother lived in Poole in Dorset, which is very near Dorchester, which is also near where Lawrence lived. So I was very aware of this man called Lawrence and that he died in a motorbike accident somewhere near Dorchester, I believe. So I'd seen the memorials to him, etc. So I knew something about him, but I didn't know really what I was going to see on the screen. Boy, do you get a great story, an extraordinary story, you know, of this guy from England who's, you know, sent to the Middle East, etc. And his love and desire to really envelop himself into desert life, basically, and the Arab world. It was really extraordinary. I was stunned and shocked in a pleasant way by the enormity of this film. This film must have cost a lot of money. It's a very expensive movie and very, very successful. It was brilliant. And I was watching, in fact, seeing Peter O'Toole as an actor. And he was a young man then. I mean, he's older than me, but he was a young man, and I could relate to him. His performance helped me to stop becoming an actor. I was never going to be in that, anywhere in that area. I wouldn't ever be employed to be playing any of the roles, I suspect. I was never going to achieve that kind of quality of performance. And it did. It helped me to decide, this really is not going to be for you, acting. That was the first one. There was another moment later, which I'm sure we're going to talk about.
Indeed. Certainly just closing our thoughts on Lawrence of Arabia for the moment. 1962, I'd say, so 6 years, five, 6 years after Bridge on the River Kwai, just about 6 or 7 years after the Dam Busters, it's still there. Looking at it now, it's intriguing, those opening sort of 20 or 30 minutes where we see that very bold decision to effectively have a motorcycle crash right at the start of the movie. And then, of course, the reflections about high society and whether he deserves his place in St. Paul's, the sort of discussion there, was Lawrence really one of us or was he somebody else, etc. And then, of course, as we mentioned earlier, the magical shot, the cutaway, which I think Lean originally was going to do a dissolve, but in the end decided to have that instant cut from the striking the match. Of the match. Exactly. Yeah.
That was a magical thing. And do you know what? It's really weird you bring that up because unbeknown to me, I didn't think about this because of that. And I'd never made that connection. When I was doing the BBC drama director's course many years later, we had a variety of projects we had to do, modules, I think you call them. So one of them was to do a little 10-minute film that you write yourself and you create the whole thing and blah, blah, blah. And I did something which was a middle-aged lady reflecting on the loss of her loved one during the First World War. And she's talking to herself. It's a voiceover. And you just see her visually doing various things. And I do exactly that. I actually have a dark... We're in darkness and suddenly a match is lit. And and as it's lit, you see her face. No, you see her face half lit. And then she strikes a light to light a candle, and I cut straight away to a big wide shot to somewhere else. Blah, blah. And it must have been subconsciously in my brain. I nicked it, mate.
It's the whole purpose of sound and director's visions, to actually tap into these kind of things. You're listening to Graham Harper's Sound and Director's Vision. We're going to be coming back to more epics after this. So, Graham, an epic drama of adventure and exploration. And again, 6 years, we've got magical sort of periods of 6 years here. 6 years after Lawrence of Arabia, we've just heard that opening unforgettable sequence from 2001 A Space Odyssey, Also sprach Zarathustra, or thus spake Zarathustra. Primarily, as again we heard on another show, because Stanley Kubrick wasn't happy with the original sort of soundtrack, so actually decided to bring on board the Richard Strauss and Johann Strauss and various other sort of folk to actually work through this. Is it fair to say that this, which obviously hit the cinemas 1 year before Neil Armstrong stepped on the surface of the moon, is very much something which opened up this whole sense of epic nature? I mean, MGM had already produced, I think they were in the Planet of the Apes was actually there, so they were into serious science fiction. Obviously, they'd done Fantastic Voyage and so on. In the 50s, Forbidden Planet. I was shocked you actually went for the Dambusters over Forbidden Planet. I would have thought that would have been a shoo-in for any influential movie, but maybe that's for another time. But share with us, obviously, your own personal collection with respect to this Stanley Kubrick. Again, another epic, it's fair to say, because that's what he sort of became known for. And why that has impacted you, and also this particular music as well.
So, during the period of 62...
England won the World Cup in 66, of course.
Yes, oh, that was epic. That was a turning point in life, never to be turned again. So from 1962, I left drama school, saw Lawrence of Arabia, was deciding, do you know what? I'm not sure I'm brave enough to be an actor. I certainly have huge stage fright in the theatre. But I carried on and I did get some lovely parts in television productions and didn't really appear in any movies, but I did get work at BBC. And as I was getting older, when I was 18, I took my driving test, passed it. The School of Motoring was in Boreham Wood, which was Hollywood, as we said before, of England, had all these studios working there. And they asked me if I would like to become a driving instructor, because they thought that as I was in the business and they were getting lots of requests from people in the studios, that it might be better they had one of their own teaching them to drive, which I thought was a very strange way, because I don't think they cared. They just wanted to be taught to drive. Because we would allow you to go off and get to auditions and get work and we'd hold your job and you can come back. So I always had a very good resting job, is how actors would talk about it. So I suggested, the money was good, so that was fine. So as a young 18-year-old, I was now about to teach people driving for a good salary, which helped me to survive whilst I wasn't working in the theatre and television or film. One day, I was working with Iris Rose, a woman called Iris Rose. I wasn't working. I was going to teach a young woman called Iris Rose from MGM Studios. So I went to pick her up. Taught her to drive for 10 or 11 weeks. In those days, it was you had 10 lessons and you were almost ready to take your test then. Came, like 3 months later, she was ready for a test, took her test, she passed. Going back to the studios to drop her off and to collect my fee, for the test run or whatever, she said to me, by then she knew that I was in the business and this was my resting job. And she said, would you like to come in and see the studio that I'm working in, and come upstairs and I can pay you? So I walked into a big set, big studio with white pods and space stations and extraordinary bits of set in this massive studio in the sort of semi-gloom, but picked out by pinpricks of light, etc. So I thought, oh, this is science fiction, space travel, blah, blah. I'm in awe of all this. I then go upstairs with her to the offices above the studio, and there's a gentleman there, and she's all, Stanley, can I introduce you to Graham? He's my driving instructor. And guess what? I've just passed. Yee-hee! And he shakes my hand. Oh, well done. Was she terrible? Blah, blah. And the usual silly conversation, a light-hearted conversation you might have for 5 minutes. I was of no interest to him other than... his assistant had passed her test and that was fine. And he was looking at a big studio plan and working out, I suppose, his shots. I went and collected my money and walked out. But I that was a eureka moment for me, because as I walked out of the studio and got my car, I thought, this is not what I want to do. I do not want to continue this. I don't want to become an actor. I'm now going to try and get into production. And indeed, Iris Rose helped me. She got me a job. Unfortunately, that job stopped on the day that I started it, on a big movie that was about to go to Switzerland. However, I carried on applying to get work. And guess what? My work started with a runner's job at the BBC. So that's 1966. All down to that eureka moment of meeting this fabulous man, Stanley Kubrick, for 3 or 4 minutes in my life. And that moment changed, that visit to the studio changed my whole outlook on what I was going to do.
And of course, Kubrick himself, by this time in his career, had actually directed Spartacus. I am Spartacus, etc. back in 1960. Lolita in 1962. And a personal favourite of mine in 1964, of course, the Peter Sellers tour de force, Dr. Strangelove, or Brilliant. How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Had you seen any of those movies? I mean, were you familiar when you knew it was Stanley Kubrick? Did you think, wow, you know, this is because I mean, at that stage, nobody knew what was going to happen with 2001 A Space Odyssey other than it's some sort of space movie.
Now, I didn't know what 2001 was. I didn't even know it was called 2001. I just saw sets and Stanley Kubrick, and I was in awe of Stanley Kubrick. I knew who I was meeting. I knew he'd made these films. The Peter Sellers film was absolutely stunning and bonkers and wonderful and so free. He was the auteur. He was in charge of that. I'm sure nobody argued with him. That was his vision. The way he wanted it, I was going to do it. So I knew I was meeting, I was in the presence of a great artist. I knew that even though I was only 18 or 19. So the next year, I think it was, that film came out. I think I was already at the BBC by then. The film came out. I went to see it and I knew it was Stanley Kubrick. I didn't know it was what I had seen in the studios. I didn't know that was the film I was going to see. I walked in, wow, I mean, it's very long, it's very slow, it's very detailed. The detail of that film captures you. And if you don't, if you're not captured by the detail, then you will find it very boring, I think.
It's not as long as Lawrence of Arabia, and it has more women in it.
But there are women in it. It's a marvellous film, but thus spake Zarathustra. When you hear that music, which we often do, people, it's played on radio, certainly on classic FM, they will play that 2 or 3 times a year, I'm sure. You cannot help but see in your mind the visuals of that, the beginning of that film. It's very evocative and it's used several times. It's a marvellous piece of music. I know that Nietzsche wrote a poem called Thus Spake Zarathustra. I know that he went on a walking holiday to Switzerland and saw this huge pyramidic kind of rock overlooking a lake, etc., which he either knew or believed had some kind of spiritual thing, alien spiritual, or was a recording machine of some sort of mankind's achievements. I don't know. Richard Strauss also took inspiration from that play, that poem. And guess what? Kubrick used the music as his inspiration for that monolithic plinth that he uses. So the whole thing, I never realized that when I was seeing it. What was this plinth? I never kind of understood the plinth other than it was symbolic of alien life. Are we the aliens? Are the aliens coming? And now I understand. Now, all these years later, I understand what that plinth, that monolith, was meant to represent, which is a kind of recording of man's achievement, if you like. And it's floating in space, and they're on the moon. They're probably on Mars. We've now found things
and,
now.
And clearly not, as people say, just a giant mobile phone, which is
it probably is. I never thought of that. So I find that film, I must have seen that film 20 to 30 times over the years, because when it's on, I'll watch it. If it's on television, I will watch it again. There's so much you miss that you see the next time you see it. It's a fantastic movie, extraordinary.
And of course, the director of cinematography, or director of cameras, the great cinematographer, who is it? Jeffrey Unsworth.
Ah, there we are. Extraordinary, isn't it? Brilliant. Very, very, very brilliant. Brilliant collaborators again.
I mean, I'm almost tempted to actually say, in some ways, is Jeffrey Unsworth the sort of equivalence to some of our late 20th century directors like Lean and indeed Kubrick, as the deep focused photography of Greg Toland was to Orson Welles? But that's another discussion for another time, basically, or the sort of deep focused cinematography that he puts into play with Citizen Kane.
But the secret was, all directors try to get on board the people that they get on with, work well with, and have an understanding between each other, kind of hidden signalling to each other of what the other would like to see on the screen, etc. And I'm the same. There are a variety of operators and DOPs and sound directors that I want to work with, because I and others, because I know we just have a fantastic collaboration. A lot of people think that some directors, it's all directing by committee, you know, they come in and go. I think directing by committee is when you come in as a director and go, oh, what should we do with this scene? How do we start? As opposed to coming in and going, right, having shown the crew what you're going to do, what the scene, you've rehearsed the scene, you allow that to be seen by the crew, and then you as a director have to say, right, the way I want to cover this is, and you tell them the variety of shots and angles and positions you're going to want to take the shots from. Then the beauty from there onwards, which I think is collaboration, is that somebody could be the runner, but someone, usually the operator and the DOP, might suggest that instead of doing three shots to cover a certain aspect, you could do one big tracking shot that would, the camera would follow the action, but would dip away to see the other two shots, but all in one. They would dip away to see that, see it picked up, or whatever the idea is, and then to develop onto another moment and then carry on the main action, thereby saving you two shots, which is probably an hour's work of the day, and becomes a bit of magic, and you suddenly go, oh yes, please, I want to do that. Or you can say, no, I want it to be a definite cut and a definite whatever, but I like the collaboration. So I call that collaboration, not directing by committee.
And it's worth noting as well, we talked about obviously Robert Bolt's importance to Lawrence of Arabia in the same way a mention to Arthur C. Clarke and his importance obviously to Stanley Kubrick in 2001: A Space Odyssey, because it was obviously Stanley Kubrick's dream to actually produce a serious science fiction movie. He spoke to Arthur C. Clarke about this. They developed it from his short story, The Sentinel. And ultimately, we got Arthur C. Clarke writing the novelization based on the original screenplay that they both put together. So again, collaboration.
Yeah, absolutely.
Zarathustra has again spoken in terms of time, Graham, because astoundingly, that's brought us to the end of the second phase, volume two. My God. Of Sound and Director's Vision, Graham Harper's Sound and Director's Vision, which basically is going to take us out with the third and final choice for today. It's those lovable chums, John, Paul, George and Ringo, a beat combo from Liverpool, who I think had a modicum of success and still actually have some success over their time, etc. A Day in the Life from Sergeant Pepper, of course. Any reasons for this before we press the button?
Yes, I moved up the ranks at the BBC from runner to eventually director over 14 years. I went on the director's course, I became a director, and I was given, within two or three years of directing, I was offered a Doctor Who, in which we were going to do a regeneration of Peter Davison into Colin Baker as Doctor Who. And I wanted to do something as magical as I could for this regeneration, you know, because each one has to be slightly different from the previous one. And I couldn't think of how to do it, what it was. and I was listening to the John Lennon part of Day in the Life from Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which came out in 67. But now it's 1983. I'm now finishing off the editing of, the shooting of this Doctor Who, and called The Caves of Androzani. And I was listening to the John Lennon side of that song, which ends with the orchestra building and building and building up with this huge cacophony of sound and ending up with a huge, massive crash of a piano chord that fades slowly away. And if you listen carefully on the disc, if you played it backwards, because as it's going round at the end, it goes blah, 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 blah. And if you play that backwards, I'm not going to tell you what they say, but they all say something all together as a group, which is fun to listen to at the end. And it was that piece of music, that end piece of music, that inspired me to create the ending that I did for the regeneration of one Doctor into the other.
I saw the photograph. He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. Seen his face before. Nobody was really sure if he was from the House of Lords. I saw a film today, oh boy. The English army had just won the war. A crowd of people turned away. But I just had to look. Having read the book, I'd love to turn you on. Fell out of bed, dragged a comb across my head. Found my way downstairs and drank a cup. And looking up, I noticed I was late. Found my coat and grabbed my hat. Made the bus in seconds flat. Found my way upstairs and had a smoke. And somebody spoke and I went into a dream.
I never could be